shape around me. I wanted the flowers, the velvet, the candles in their sconces, to be mortal and trivial and safe. And then, as if in a mist, I saw a woman there. She was seated calmly at that lavish table where Claudia attended to her hair. And so still she sat, so utterly without fear, her green taffeta sleeves reflected in the tilted mirrors, her skirts reflected, that she was not one still woman, but a gathering of women. Her dark red hair was parted in the middle, and drawn back to her ears, though a dozen little ringlets escaped to make a frame for her pale face. And she was looking at me with two calm, violet eyes and a child's mouth that seemed almost obdurately soft, obdurately the cupid's bow unsullied by paint or personality. And the mouth smiled now and said, as those eyes seemed to fire, "Yes, he's as you said he would be, and I love him already. He's as you said." She rose now, gently lifting that abundance of dark taffeta, and the three small mirrors emptied at once. And utterly baffled, and almost incapable of speech, I turned to see Claudia far off on the immense bed, her small face rigidly calm, though she clung to the silk curtain with a tight fist. "Madeline," she said under her breath, "Louis is shy." And she watched with cold eyes as Madeline only smiled when she said this, and, drawing closer to me, put both of her hands to the lace fringe around her throat, moving it back so I could see the two small marks there. Then the smile died on her lips, and they became at once sullen and sensual as her eyes narrowed and she breathed the word, "Drink." I turned away from her, my fist rising in a consternation for which I couldn't find words. But then Claudia had hold of that fist and was looking up at me with relentless eyes. "Do it, Louis," she commanded, "because I cannot do it." Her voice was painfully calm, all the emotion under the hard, measured tone. "I haven't the size, I haven't the strength. You saw to that when you made me. Do it!" I broke away from her, clutching my wrist as if she'd burned it. I could see the door, and it seemed to me the better part of wisdom to leave by it at once. I could feel Claudia's strength, her will, and a mortal woman's eyes seemed afire with that same will, but Claudia held me, not with a gentle pleading, a miserable coaxing that would have dissipated that power, making me feel pity for her as I gathered my own forces. She held me with the emotion her eyes had evinced even through her coldness and the way that she turned away from me now, almost as if she'd been instantly defeated. I did not understand the manner in which she sank back on the bed, her head bowed, her lips moving feverishly, her eyes rising only to scan the walls. I wanted to touch her and say to her that what she asked was impossible. I wanted to soothe that fire that seemed to be consuming her from within. And the soft, mortal woman had settled into one of the velvet chairs by the fire, with the rustling and iridescence of her taffeta dress surrounding her like part of the mystery of her dispassionate eyes which watched us now, the fever of her pale face. I remember turning to her, spurred on by that childish, pouting mouth set against the fragile face. The vampire kiss had left no visible trace except the wound, no inalterable change on the pale pink flesh. "How do we appear to you?" I asked, seeing her eyes on Claudia. She seemed excited by the diminutive beauty, the awful woman's passion knotted in the small dimpled hands. She broke her gaze and looked up at me. "I ask you, how do we appear? Do you think us beautiful, magical, our white skin, our fierce eyes? Oh, I remember perfectly what mortal vision was, the dimness of it, and how the vampire's beauty burned through that veil, so powerfully alluring, so utterly deceiving. Drink, you tell me. You haven't the vaguest conception under God of what you ask." but Claudia rose from the bed and came towards me. "How dare you?" she whispered. "How dare you make this decision for both of us? Do you know how I despise you? Do you know that I despise you with a passion that eats at me like a canker?" Her small form trembled, her hands hovering over the pleated bodice of her yellow gown. "Don't you look away from me. I am sick at heart with your looking away, with your suffering. You understand nothing. Your evil is that you cannot be evil, and I must suffer for it. I tell you, I will suffer no longer." Her fingers bit into the flesh of my wrist. I twisted, stepping back from her, floundering in the face of the hatred, the rage rising like some dormant beast in her, looking out through her eyes. "Snatching me from mortal hands like two grim monsters in a nightmare fairy tale, you idle, blind parents! Fathers," she spat the word, "let tears gather in your eyes. You haven't tears enough for what you've done to me. 6 more mortal years, 7, 8. I might have had that shape." Her pointed finger flew at Madeline, whose hands had risen to her face, whose eyes were clouded over. Her moan was almost Claudia's name, but Claudia did not hear her. "Yes, that shape. I might have known what it was to walk at your side. Monsters! To give me immortality in this hopeless guise, this helpless form!" The tears stood in her eyes. The words had died away, drawn in as it were on her breast. "Now you give her to me," she said, her head bowing, her curls tumbling down to make a concealing veil. "You give her to me. You do this, or you finish what you did to me that night in the hotel in New Orleans. I will not live with this hatred any longer. I will not live with this rage. I cannot. I will not abide it." And tossing her hair, she put her hands to her ears as if to stop the sound of her own words, her breath drawn in rapid gasps, the tears seeming to scald her cheeks. I had sunk to my knees at her side, and my arms were outstretched as if to enfold her. Yet I dared not touch her, dared not even say her name, lest my own pain break from me with the first syllable in a monstrous outpouring of hopelessly inarticulate cries. "Oh!" she shook her head now, squeezing the tears out onto her cheeks, her teeth clenched tight together. "I love you still. That's the torment of it. Lest that I never loved. But you, the measure of my hatred is that love. They are the same. Do you know now how much I hate you?" She flashed at me through the red film that covered her eyes. "Yes," I whispered. I bowed my head. But she was gone from me into the arms of Madeline, who enfolded her desperately, as if she might protect Claudia from me. The irony of it, the pathetic irony, protect Claudia from herself. She was whispering to Claudia, "Don't cry, don't cry," her hands stroking Claudia's face and hair with a fierceness that would have bruised a human child. But Claudia seemed lost against her breast suddenly, her eyes closed, her face smooth, as if all passion were drained away from her, her arm sliding up around Madeline's neck, her head falling against the taffeta and lace. She lay still, the tears staining her cheeks, as if all this that had risen to the surface had left her weak and desperate for oblivion, as if the room around her, as if I, were not there. And there they were together, a tender mortal crying unstintingly now, her warm arms holding what she could not possibly understand, this white and fierce and unnatural child thing she believed she loved. And if I had not felt for her, this mad and reckless woman flirting with the damned, if I had not felt all the sorrow for her I felt for my mortal self, I would have wrested the demon thing from her arms, held it tight to me, denying over and over the words I'd just heard. But I knelt there still, thinking only, "The love is equal to the hatred." Gathering that selfishly to my own breast, holding on to that as I sank back against the bed. A long time before Madeleine was to know it, Claudia had ceased crying, and sat still as a statue on Madeleine's lap, her liquid eyes fixed on me, oblivious to the soft, red hair that fell around her, or the woman's hand that still stroked her. And I sat, slumped against the bedpost, staring back at those vampire eyes, unable and unwilling to speak in my defense. Madeleine was whispering into Claudia's ear. She was letting her tears fall into Claudia's tresses, and then, gently, Claudia said to her, "Leave us." "No," she shook her head, holding tight to Claudia, and then she shut her eyes and trembled all over with some terrible vexation, some awful torment. But Claudia was leading her from the chair, and she was now pliant and shocked and white-faced, the green taffeta ballooning around the small yellow silk dress. In the archway of the parlor they stopped, and Madeleine stood as if confused, her hand at her throat, beating like a wing, then going still. She looked about her like that hapless victim on the stage of the Théâtre des Vampires, who did not know where she was. But Claudia had gone for something, and I saw her emerge from the shadows with what appeared to be a large doll. I rose on my knees to look at it. It was a doll, the doll of a little girl with raven hair and green eyes, adorned with lace and ribbons, sweet-faced and wide-eyed, its porcelain feet tinkling as Claudia put it into Madeleine's arms. And Madeleine's eyes appeared to harden as she held the doll, and her lips drew back from her teeth in a grimace as she stroked its hair. She was laughing, low under her breath. "Lie down," Claudia said to her, and together they appeared to sink into the cushions of the couch, the green taffeta rustling and giving way as Claudia lay with her and put her arms around her neck. I saw the doll sliding, dropping to the floor, yet Madeleine's hand groped for it and held it dangling, her own head thrown back, her eyes shut tight, and Claudia's curls stroking her face. I settled back on the floor, and leaned against the soft siding of the bed. Claudia was speaking now in a low voice, barely above a whisper, telling Madeleine to be patient, to be still. I dreaded the sound of her step on the carpet, the sound of the doors sliding closed to shut Madeleine away from us, and the hatred that lay between us like a killing vapor. But when I looked up to her, Claudia was standing there as if transfixed and lost in thought, all rancor and bitterness gone from her face, so that she had the blank expression of that doll. "All you've said to me is true," I said to her. "I deserve your hatred. I've deserved it from those first moments when Lestat put you in my arms." She seemed unaware of me, and her eyes were infused with a soft light. Her beauty burned into my soul so that I could hardly stand it, and then she said, wondering, "You could have killed me then despite him. You could have done it." Then her eyes rested on me calmly. "Do you wish to do it now?" "Do it now?" I put my arm around her, moved her close to me, warned by her softened voice. "Are you mad to say such things to me? Do I want to do it now?" "I want you to do it," she said. "Bend down now as you did then. Draw the blood out of me drop by drop, all you have the strength for. Push my heart to the brink. I am small, you can take me. I won't resist you. I am something frail you can crush like a flower."
"You mean these things? You mean what you say to me?" I asked. "Why don't you place the knife here? Why don't you turn it?"
"Would you die with me?" she asked, with a sly mocking smile. "Would you in fact die with me?" she pressed. "Don't you understand what is happening to me? That he is killing me, that master vampire who has you in thrall, that he won't share your love with me, not a drop of it. I see his power in your eyes. I see your misery, your distress, the love for him you can't hide. Turn around. I'll make you look at me with those eyes that want him. I'll make you listen."
"Don't any more. Don't. I won't leave you.
I've sworn to you, don't you see? I cannot give you that woman, but I'm fighting for my life. Give her to me so she can care for me, complete the guise I must have to live, and he can have you then. I am fighting for my life. I all but shoved her off. No, no, it's madness, it's witchery, I said, trying to defy her. It's you who will not share me with him. It's you who want every drop of that love. If not from me, from her. He overpowers you, he disregards you, and it's you who wish him dead the way that you killed Lestat. Well, you won't make me a party to this death, I tell you, not this death. I will not make her one of us. I will not damn the legions of mortals who'll die at her hands if I do. Your power over me is broken. I will not. Oh, if she could only have understood. Not for a moment could I truly believe her words against Armand, that out of that detachment, which was beyond revenge, he could selfishly wish for her death. But that was nothing to me now. Something far more terrible than I could grasp was happening, something I was only beginning to understand, against which my anger was nothing but a mockery, a hollow attempt to oppose her tenacious will. She hated me. She loathed me, as she herself had confessed, and my heart shriveled inside me, as if, in depriving me of that love which had sustained me a lifetime, she had dealt me a mortal blow. The knife was there. I was dying for her, dying for that love, as I was that very first night when Lestat gave her to me, turned her eyes to me and told her my name. That love which had warmed me in my self-hatred, allowed me to exist. Oh, how Lestat had understood it, and now at last his plan was undone. But it went beyond that, in some region from which I was shrinking as I strode back and forth, my hands opening and closing at my sides, feeling not only that hatred in her liquid eyes, it was her pain. She had shown me her pain. To give me immortality in this hopeless guise, this helpless form. I put my hands to my ears, as if she spoke the words yet, and the tears flowed. For all these years I had depended utterly upon her cruelty, her absolute lack of pain, and pain was what she showed to me, undeniable pain. Oh, how Lestat would have laughed at us! That was why she had put the knife to him, because he would have laughed. To destroy me utterly she need only show me that pain. The child I made a vampire suffered. Her agony was as my own. There was a coffin in that other room, a bed for Madeleine, to which Claudia retreated to leave me alone with what I could not abide. I welcomed the silence. And sometime, during the few hours that remained of the night, I found myself at the open window, feeling the slow mist of the rain. It glistened on the fronds of the ferns, on sweet white flowers that listed, bowed, and finally broke from their stems. A carpet of flowers littering the little balcony. The petals pounded softly by the rain. I felt weak now, and utterly alone. What had passed between us tonight could never be undone, and what had been done to Claudia by me could never be undone. But I was somehow, to my own bewilderment, empty of all regret. Perhaps it was the night, the starless sky, the gas lamps frozen in the mist, that gave some strange comfort for which I never asked and didn't know how, in this emptiness and aloneness, to receive. I am alone, I was thinking. I am alone. It seemed just, perfectly, and so to have a pleasing, inevitable form, and I pictured myself then forever alone, as if on gaining that vampire strength the night of my death, I had left Lestat and never looked back for him, as if I had moved on away from him, beyond the need of him and anyone else, as if the night had said to me, "You are the night," and the night alone understands you and enfolds you in its arms. One with the shadows, without nightmare, an inexplicable peace. Yet I could feel the end of this peace as surely as I'd felt my brief surrender to it, and it was breaking like the dark clouds. The urgent pain of Claudia's loss pressed in on me, behind me, like a shape gathered from the corners of this cluttered and oddly alien room. But outside, even as the night seemed to dissolve in a fierce, driving wind, I could feel something calling to me, something inanimate which I'd never known. And a power within me seemed to answer that power, not with resistance, but with an inscrutable, chilling strength. I moved silently through the rooms, gently dividing the doors until I saw, in the dim light cast by the flickering gas flames behind me, that sleeping woman lying in my shadow on the couch, the doll limp against her breast. Some time before I knelt at her side, I saw her eyes open, and I could feel beyond her, in the collected dark, those other eyes watching me, that breathless, tiny vampire face waiting. "Will you care for her, Madeline?" I saw her hands clutch at the doll, turning its face against her breast, and my own hand went out for it, though I did not know why, even as she was answering me. "Yes," she repeated it again, desperately. "Is this what you believe her to be? A doll?" I asked her, my hand closing on the doll's head, only to feel her snatch it away from me, see her teeth clenched as she glared at me. "A child who can't die, that's what she is," she said, as if she were pronouncing a curse. "Ah," I whispered. "I've done with dolls," she said, shoving it away from her into the cushions of the couch. She was fumbling with something on her breast, something she wanted me to see and not to see, her fingers catching hold of it and closing over it. I knew what it was, had noticed it before. A locket fixed with a gold pin. I wish I could describe the passion that infected her round features, how her soft baby mouth was distorted. "And the child who did die," I guessed, watching her. I was picturing a doll shop, dolls with the same face. She shook her head, her hand pulling hard on the locket so the pin ripped the taffeta. It was fear I saw in her now, a consuming panic, and her hand bled as she opened it from the broken pin. I took the locket from her fingers. "My daughter," she whispered, her lip trembling. It was a doll's face on the small fragment of porcelain. Claudia's face, a baby face, a saccharine, sweet mockery of innocence an artist had painted there, a child with raven hair like the doll. And the mother, terrified, was staring at the darkness in front of her. "Grief," I said gently. "I've done with grief," she said, her eyes narrowing as she looked up at me. "If you knew how I longed to have your power... I'm ready for it. I hunger for it." And she turned to me, breathing deeply so that her breast seemed to swell under her dress. A violent frustration rent her face then. She turned away from me, shaking her head, her curls. "If you were a mortal man, man and monster," she said angrily, "if I could only show you my power." And she smiled malignantly, defiantly at me. "I could make you want me. Desire me. But you're unnatural." Her mouth went down at the corners. "What can I give you? What can I do to make you give me what you have?" Her hand hovered over her breasts, seeming to caress them like a man's hand. It was strange, that moment. Strange because I could never have predicted the feeling her words incited in me, the way that I saw her now, with that small, enticing waist, saw the round, plump curve of her breasts and those delicate, pouting lips. She never dreamed what the mortal man in me was, how tormented I was by the blood I'd only just drunk. Desire her I did, more than she knew, because she didn't understand the nature of the kill. And with a man's pride I wanted to prove that to her, to humiliate her for what she had said to me, for the cheap vanity of her provocation, and for the eyes that looked away from me now in disgust. But this was madness. These were not reasons to grant eternal life. And cruelly, Surely, I said to her, did you love this child? I will never forget her face then, the violence in her, the absolute hatred. Yes, she all but hissed the words at me. How dare you? She reached for the locket even as I clutched it. It was guilt that was consuming her, not love. It was guilt. That shop of dolls Claudia had described to me, shelves and shelves of the effigy of that dead child. But guilt that absolutely understood the finality of death. There was something as hard in her as the evil in myself, something as powerful. She had her hand out towards me. She touched my waistcoat and opened her fingers there, pressing them against my chest. And I was on my knees, drawing close to her, her hair brushing my face. "Hold fast to me when I take you," I said to her, seeing her eyes grow wide, her mouth open. "And when the swoon is strongest, listen all the harder for the beating of my heart. Hold, and say over and over, I will live." "Yes, yes," she was nodding, her heart pounding with her excitement. Her hands burnt on my neck, fingers forcing their way into my collar. "Look beyond me at that distant light. Don't take your eyes off of it, not for a second, and say over and over, I will live." She gasped as I broke the flesh, the warm current coming into me, her breasts crushed against me, her body arching up, helpless from the couch. And I could see her eyes, even as I shut my own, see that taunting, provocative mouth. I was drawing on her hard, lifting her, and I could feel her weakening, her hands dropping limp at her sides. "Tight, tight," I whispered over the hot stream of her blood, her heart thundering in my ears, her blood swelling my satiated veins. "The lamp," I whispered, "look at it." Her heart was slowing, stopping, and her head dropped back from me on the velvet, her eyes dull to the point of death. It seemed for a moment I couldn't move, yet I knew I had to, that someone else was lifting my wrist to my mouth as the room turned round and round, that I was focusing on that light as I had told her to do, as I tasted my own blood from my own wrist and then forced it into her mouth. "Drink it, drink," I said to her. But she lay as if dead. I gathered her close to me, the blood pouring over her lips. Then she opened her eyes, and I felt the gentle pressure of her mouth, and then her hands closing tight on the arm as she began to suck. I was rocking her, whispering to her, trying desperately to break my swoon, and then I felt her powerful pull. Every blood vessel felt it. I was threaded through and through with her pulling, my hand holding fast to the couch now, her heart beating fierce against my heart, her fingers digging deep into my arm, my outstretched palm. It was cutting me, scoring me, so I all but cried out as it went on, and I was backing away from her, yet pulling her with me, my life passing through my arm, her moaning breath in time with her pulling, and those strings which were my veins, those searing wires pulled at my very heart, harder and harder until, without will or direction, I had wrenched free of her and fallen away from her, clutching that bleeding wrist tight with my own hand. She was staring at me, the blood staining her open mouth. An eternity seemed to pass as she stared. She doubled and tripled in my blurred vision, then collapsed into one trembling shape. Her hand moved to her mouth, yet her eyes did not move but grew large in her face as she stared. And then she rose slowly, not as if by her own power, but as if lifted from the couch bodily by some invisible force which held her now, staring as she turned round and round, her massive skirt moving stiff as if she were all of a piece, turning like some great carved ornament on a music box that dances helplessly round and round to the music. And suddenly she was staring down at the taffeta, grabbing hold of it, pressing it between her fingers so it zinged and rustled, and she let it fall, quickly covering her ears, her eyes shut tight, then opened wide again. And then it seemed she saw the lamp, the distant, low gas lamp of the other room that gave a fragile light through the double doors, and she ran to it and stood beside it, watching it as if it were alive. "Don't touch it," Claudia said to her, and gently guided her away. But Madeleine had seen the flowers on the balcony, and she was drawing close to them now, her outstretched palms brushing the petals and then pressing the droplets of rain to her face. I was hovering on the fringes of the room, watching her every move, how she took the flowers and crushed them in her hands, and let the petals fall all around her, and how she pressed her fingertips to the mirror and stared into her own eyes. My own pain had ceased. A handkerchief bound the wound, and I was waiting, waiting, seeing now that Claudia had no knowledge from memory of what was to come next. They were dancing together, as Madeleine's skin grew paler and paler in the unsteady golden light. She scooped Claudia into her arms, and Claudia rode round in circles with her, her own small face alert and wary behind her smile. And then Madeleine weakened. She stepped backwards and seemed to lose her balance, but quickly she righted herself and let Claudia go gently down to the ground. On tiptoe, Claudia embraced her. "Louis," she signalled to me under her breath. "Louis." I beckoned for her to come away, and Madeleine, not seeming even to see us, was staring at her own outstretched hands. Her face was blanched and drawn, and suddenly she was scratching at her lips and staring at the dark stains on her fingertips. "No, no," I cautioned her gently, taking Claudia's hand and holding her close to my side. A long moan escaped Madeleine's lips. "Louis," Claudia whispered, in that preternatural voice which Madeleine could not yet hear. "She is dying, which your child's mind can't remember. You were spared it. It left no mark on you," I whispered to her, brushing the hair back from her ear, my eyes never leaving Madeleine, who was wandering from mirror to mirror, the tears flowing freely now, the body giving up its life. "But Louis, if she dies," Claudia cried. "No." I knelt down, seeing the distress in her small face. The blood was strong enough. She will live. But she will be afraid. Terribly afraid. And gently, firmly, I pressed Claudia's hand and kissed her cheek. She looked at me then with mingled wonder and fear. And she watched me with the same expression as I wandered closer to Madeleine, drawn by her cries. She reeled now, her hands out, and I caught her and held her close. Her eyes already burned with unnatural light, a violet fire reflected in her tears. "It's mortal death. Only mortal death," I said to her gently. "Do you see the sky? We must leave it now, and you must hold tight to me, lie by my side. A sleep as heavy as death will come over my limbs, and I won't be able to solace you, and you will lie there, and you will struggle with it, but you hold tight to me in the darkness, do you hear? You hold tight to my hands, which will hold your hands as long as I have feeling." She seemed lost for the moment in my gaze, and I sensed the wonder that surrounded her, how the radiance of my eyes was the radiance of all colors, and how all those colors were all the more reflected for her in my eyes. I guided her gently to the coffin, telling her again not to be afraid. "When you arise, you will be immortal," I said. "No natural cause of death can harm you. Come, lie down." I could see her fear of it, see her shrink from the narrow box, its satin no comfort. Already her skin began to glisten, to have that brilliance that Claudia and I shared. I knew now she would not surrender until I lay with her. I held her and looked across the long vista of the room to where Claudia stood, with that strange coffin, watching me. Her eyes were still but dark, with an undefined suspicion, a cool distrust. I set Madeleine down beside her bed and moved towards those eyes. And, kneeling calmly beside her, I gathered Claudia in my arms, "Don't you recognize me?" I asked her. "Don't you know who I am?" She looked at me. "No," she said. I smiled. I nodded. "Bear me no ill will," I said. "We are even." At that she moved her head to one side and studied me carefully, then seemed to smile despite herself and to nod in assent. "For you see," I said to her in that same calm voice, "what died tonight in this room was not that woman. It will take her many nights to die, perhaps years. What has died in this room tonight is the last vestige in me of what was human." A shadow fell over her face, clear as if the composure were rent like a veil, and her lips parted, but only with a short intake of breath. Then she said, "Well, then you are right, indeed. We are even." "I want to burn the doll shop." Madeline told us this. She was feeding to the fire in the grate the folded dresses of that dead daughter. White lace and beige linen, crinkled shoes, bonnets that smelled of camphor balls and sachet.
"It means nothing now, any of it."
She stood back watching the fire blaze, and she looked at Claudia with triumphant, fiercely devoted eyes. I did not believe her, so certain I was, even though night after night I had to lead her away from men and women she could no longer drain dry. So satiated was she with the blood of earlier kills, often lifting her victims off their feet in her passion, crushing their throats with her ivory fingers as surely as she drank their blood. So certain I was that sooner or later this mad intensity must abate, and she would take hold of the trappings of this nightmare, her own luminescent flesh, these lavish rooms of the Hotel Saint Gabriel, and cry out to be awakened, to be free. She did not understand it was no experiment. Showing her fledgling teeth to the gilt-edged mirrors, she was mad. But I still did not realize how mad she was, and how accustomed to dreaming, and that she would not cry out for reality, rather would feed reality to her dreams, a demon elf feeding her spinning wheel with the reeds of the world so she might make her own web-like universe. I was just beginning to understand her avarice, her magic. She had a dollmaker's craft from making with her old lover over and over the replica of her dead child, which I was to understand crowded the shelves of this shop we were soon to visit. Added to that was a vampire's skill, and a vampire's intensity, so that in the space of one night, when I had turned her away from killing, she, with that same insatiable need, created out of a few sticks of wood with her chisel and knife, a perfect rocking chair, so shaped and proportioned for Claudia that seated in it by the fire, she appeared a woman. To that must be added, as the nights passed, a table of the same scale, and from a toy shop, a tiny oil lamp, a china cup and saucer, and from a lady's purse a little leather-bound book for notes which in Claudia's hands became a large volume. The world crumbled and ceased to exist at the boundary of the small space which soon became the length and breadth of Claudia's dressing-room, a bed whose posters reached only to my breast buttons, and small mirrors that reflected only the legs of an unwieldy giant when I found myself lost among them. Paintings hung low for Claudia's eye, and finally, upon her little vanity table, black evening gloves for tiny fingers, a woman's low-cut gown of midnight velvet, a tiara from a child's masked ball, and Claudia, the crowning jewel, a fairy queen with bare white shoulders, wandering with her sleek tresses among the rich items of her tiny world, while I watched from the doorway, spellbound, ungainly, stretched out on the carpet so I could lean my head on my elbow and gaze up into my paramour's eyes, seeing them mysteriously softened for the time being by the perfection of this sanctuary. How beautiful she was in black lace, a cold, flaxen-haired woman with a Cupid doll's face and liquid eyes which gazed at me so serenely and so long that surely I must have forgotten. The eyes must be seeing something other than me as I lay there on the floor dreaming, something other than the clumsy universe surrounding me, which was now marked off and nullified by someone who had suffered in it. Someone who had suffered always, but who was not seeming to suffer now, listening, as it were, to the tinkling of a toy music box, putting a hand on the toy clock. I saw a vision of shortened hours and little golden minutes. I felt I was mad. I put my hands under my head and gazed at the chandelier. It was hard to disengage myself from one world and enter the other. And Madeleine, on the couch, was working with that regular passion, as if immortality could not conceivably mean rest, sewing cream lace to lavender satin for the small bed, only stopping occasionally to blot the moisture tinged with blood from her white forehead. I wondered, if I shut my eyes, would this realm of tiny things consume the rooms around me? And would I, like Gulliver, awake to discover myself bound hand and foot, an unwelcome giant? I had a vision of houses made for Claudia, in whose garden mice would be monsters, and tiny carriages and flowery shrubbery become trees. Mortals would be so entranced, and drop to their knees to look into the small windows. Like the spider's web, it would attract. I was bound hand and foot here, not only by that fairy beauty, that exquisite secret of Claudia's white shoulders and the rich lustre of pearls, bewitching languor, a tiny bottle of perfume, now a decanter from which a spell is released that promises Eden. I was bound by fear that outside these rooms, where I supposedly presided over the education of Madeleine, erratic conversations about killing and vampire nature, in which Claudia could have instructed so much more easily than I, if she had ever showed the desire to take the lead, that outside these rooms, where nightly I was reassured with soft kisses and contented looks, that the hateful passion which Claudia had shown once and once only would not return, that outside these rooms I would find that I was, according to my own hasty admission, truly changed. The mortal part of me was that part which had loved, I was certain. So what did I feel then for Armand, the creature for whom I transformed Madeleine, the creature for whom I had wanted to be free? A curious and disturbing distance? A dull pain? A nameless tremor? Even in this worldly clutter, I saw Armand in his monkish cell, saw his dark brown eyes, and felt that eerie magnetism. And yet I did not move to go to him. I did not dare discover the extent of what I might have lost, nor try to separate that loss from some other oppressive realization, that in Europe I'd found no truths to lessen loneliness, transform despair. Rather, I'd found only the inner workings of my own small soul. The pain of Claudius had a passion for a vampire who was perhaps more evil than Lestat, for whom I became as evil as Lestat, but in whom I saw the only promise of good in evil of which I could conceive. It was all beyond me, finally, and so the clock ticked on the mantel, and Madeleine begged to see the performances of the Théâtre des Vampires, and swore to defend Claudia against any vampire who dared insult her. And Claudia spoke of strategy, and said, "Not yet, not now." And I lay back, observing with some measure of relief Madeleine's love for Claudia, her blind covetous passion. Oh, I have so little compassion in my heart, or memory, for Madeleine. I thought she had only seen the first vein of suffering. She had no understanding of death. She was so easily sharpened, so easily driven to wanton violence. I supposed in my colossal conceit and self-deception that my own grief for my dead brother was the only true emotion. I allowed myself to forget how totally I had fallen in love with Lestat's iridescent eyes, that I'd sold my soul for a many-colored and luminescent thing, thinking that a highly reflective surface conveyed the power to walk on water. What would Christ need have done to make me follow him like Matthew or Peter? Dress well, to begin with, and have a luxurious head of pampered yellow hair. I hated myself, and it seemed lulled half to sleep as I was so often by their conversation, Claudia whispering of killing and speed and vampire craft, Madeleine bent over her singing needle, it seemed then the only emotion of which I was still capable. Hatred of self. I love them. I hate them. I do not care if they are there. Claudia puts her hands on my hair as if she wants to tell me with the old familiarity that her heart's at peace. I do not care. And there is the apparition of Armand, that power, that heartbreaking clarity, beyond a glass, it seems. And taking Claudia's playful hand, I understand for the first time in my life what she feels when she forgives me for being myself whom she says she hates and loves. She feels almost nothing. It was a week before we accompanied Madeleine on her errand, to torch a universe of dolls behind a plate glass window. I remember wandering up the street away from it, round a turn into a narrow cavern of darkness where the falling rain was the only sound. But then I saw the red glare against the clouds. Bells clanged and men shouted, and Claudia beside me was talking softly of the nature of fire. The thick smoke rising in that flickering glare unnerved me. I was feeling fear, not a wild, mortal fear, but something cold, like a hook in my side. This fear, it was the old townhouse burning in the Rue Royale, Lestat in the attitude of sleep on the burning floor. "Fire purifies," Claudia said, and I said, "No. Fire merely destroys." Madeleine had gone past us and was roaming at the top of the street, a phantom in the rain, her white hands whipping the air, beckoning to us white arcs of white fireflies. And I remember Claudia leaving me for her, the sight of wilted, writhing yellow hair as she told me to follow, a ribbon fallen underfoot, flapping and floating in a swirl of black water. It seemed they were gone, and I bent to retrieve that ribbon. But another hand reached out for it. It was Armand who gave it to me now. I was shocked to see him there, so near, the figure of Gentleman Death in a doorway, marvelously real in his black cape and silk tie, yet ethereal as the shadows in his stillness. There was the faintest glimmer of the fire in his eyes, red warming the blackness there to the richer brown. And I woke suddenly, as if I'd been dreaming, woke to the sense of him, to his hand enclosing mine, to his head inclined as if to let me know he wanted me to follow. I woke to my own excited experience of his presence, which consumed me as surely as it had consumed me in his cell. We were walking together now, fast, nearing the Seine, moving so swiftly and artfully through a gathering of men that they scarce saw us, that we scarce saw them. That I could keep up with him easily amazed me. He was forcing me into some acknowledgment of my powers, that the paths I'd normally chosen were human paths I no longer need follow. I wanted desperately to talk to him, to stop him with both my hands on his shoulders, merely to look into his eyes again as I'd done that last night, to fix him in some time and place, so that I could deal with the excitement inside me. There was so much I wanted to tell him, so much I wanted to explain. And yet I didn't know what to say, or why I would say it, only that the fullness of the feeling continued to relieve me almost to tears. This was what I'd feared lost. I didn't know where we were now, only that in my wanderings I'd passed here before, a street of ancient mansions, of garden walls and carriage doors and towers overhead and windows of leaded glass beneath stone arches, houses of other centuries, gnarled trees, that sudden, thick and silent tranquillity which means that the masses are shut out. A handful of mortals inhabit this vast region of high-ceilinged rooms. Stone absorbs the sound of breathing, the space of whole lives.
Armand was atop a wall now, his arm against the overhanging bough of a tree, his hand reaching for me. And in an instant I stood beside him, the wet foliage brushing my face. Above, I could see story after story rising to a lone tower that barely emerged from the dark, teeming rain. "Listen to me. We are going to climb to the tower," Armand was saying.
"I cannot. It's impossible."
"You don't begin to know your own powers. You can climb easily. Remember, if you fall, you will not be injured. Do as I do. But note this. The inhabitants of this house have known me for 100 years and think me a spirit. So if by chance they see you, or you see them through those windows, remember what they believe you to be and show no consciousness of them, lest you disappoint them or confuse them. Do you hear?
You are perfectly safe."
I wasn't sure what frightened me more, the climb itself or the notion of being seen as a ghost. But I had no time for comforting witticisms, even to myself. Armand had begun, his boots finding the cracks between the stones, his hands sure as claws in the crevices, and I was moving after him, tight to the wall, not daring to look down, clinging for a moment's rest to the thick, carved arch over a window, glimpsing inside, over a licking fire, a dark shoulder, a hand stroking with a poker, some figure that moved completely without knowledge that it was watched. Gone. Higher and higher we climbed until we had reached the window of the tower itself, which Armand quickly wrenched open, his long legs disappearing over the sill, and I rose up after him, feeling his arm out around my shoulders. I sighed, despite myself, as I stood in the room, rubbing the backs of my arms, looking around this wet, strange place. The rooftops were silver below, turrets rising here and there through the huge, rustling treetops, and far off glimmered the broken chain of a lighted boulevard. The room seemed as damp as the night outside. Armand was making a fire. From a moulding pile of furniture he was picking chairs, breaking them into wood easily despite the thickness of their rungs. There was something grotesque about him, sharpened by his grace and the imperturbable calm of his white face. He did what any vampire could do, cracking these thick pieces of wood into splinters, yet he did what only a vampire could do. And there seemed nothing human about him. Even his handsome features and dark hair became the attributes of a terrible angel who shared with the rest of us only a superficial resemblance. The tailored coat was a mirage. And though I felt drawn to him, more strongly perhaps than I'd ever been drawn to any living creature save Claudia, he excited me in other ways which resembled fear. I was not surprised that, when he finished, he set a heavy oak chair down for me, but retired himself to the marble mantelpiece and sat there warming his hands over the fire, the flames throwing red shadows into his face. "I can hear the inhabitants of the house," I said to him. The warmth was good. I could feel the leather of my boots drying, feel the warmth in my fingers.
"Then you know that I can hear them," he said softly. And though this didn't contain a hint of reproach, I realized the implications of my own words.
"And if they come?" I insisted, studying him.
"Can't you tell by my manner that they won't come?" he asked. "We could sit here all night and never speak of them. I want you to know that if we speak of them, it is because you want to do so." And when I said nothing, when perhaps I looked a little defeated, he said gently that they had long ago sealed off this tower and left it undisturbed. And if, in fact, they saw the smoke from the chimney or the light in the window, none of them would venture up until tomorrow. I could see now there were several shelves of books at one side of the fireplace, and a writing table. The pages on top were wilted, but there was an inkstand and several pens. I could imagine the room a very comfortable place when it was not storming as it was now, or after the fire had dried out the air. "You see," Armand said, You really have no need of the rooms you have at the hotel. You really have need of very little. But each of us must decide how much he wants. These people in this house have a name for me. Encounters with me cause talk for 20 years. They are only isolated instants in my time, which mean nothing. They cannot hurt me, and I use their house to be alone. No one of the Théâtre des Vampires knows of my coming here. This is my secret. I had watched him intently as he was speaking, and thoughts which had occurred to me in the cell of the theatre occurred to me again. Vampires do not age, and I wondered how his youthful face and manner might differ now from what he had been a century before or a century before that. For his face, though not deepened by the lessons of maturity, was certainly no mask. It seemed powerfully expressive, as was his unobtrusive voice, and I was at a loss, finally, to fully anatomize why. I knew only I was as powerfully drawn to him as before, and to some extent the words I spoke now were a subterfuge. "But what holds you to the Théâtre des Vampires?" I asked. "A need, naturally. But I found what I need," he said. "Why do you shun me?" "I never shunned you," I said, trying to hide the excitement these words produced in me. "You understand I have to protect Claudia, that she has no one but me. Or at least she had no one until Madeleine came to live with you." "Yes," I said. "But now Claudia has released you, yet still you stay with her, and stay bound to her as your paramour," he said. "No, she's no paramour of mine. You don't understand," I said. "Rather, she's my child, and I don't know that she can release me." These were thoughts I'd gone over and over in my mind. I don't know if the child possesses the power to release the parent. I don't know that I won't be bound to her for as long as she... I stopped. I was going to say, for as long as she lives. But I realized it was a hollow, mortal cliché. She would live forever, as I would live forever. But wasn't it so for mortal fathers? Their daughters live forever because these fathers die first. I was at a loss suddenly, but conscious all the while of how Armand listened, that he listened in the way that we dream of others listening, his face seeming to reflect on everything said. He did not start forward to seize on my slightest pause, to assert an understanding of something before the thought was finished, or to argue with a swift, irresistible impulse the things which often make dialogue impossible. After a long interval, he said, "I want you. I want you more than anything in the world." For a moment I doubted what I'd heard. It struck me as unbelievable, and I was hopelessly disarmed by it, and the wordless vision of our living together expanded and obliterated every other consideration in my mind. "I said that I want you. I want you more than anything in the world," he repeated, with only a subtle change of expression. And then he sat waiting, watching. His face was as tranquil as always, his smooth white forehead beneath the shock of his auburn hair, without a trace of care, his large eyes reflecting on me, his lips still. "You want this of me, yet you don't come to me," he said. "There are things you want to know, and you don't ask. You see Claudia slipping away from you, yet you seem powerless to prevent it. And then you would hasten it, and yet you do nothing." "I don't understand my own feelings. Perhaps they are clearer to you than they are to me." "You don't begin to know what a mystery you are," he said. "But at least you know yourself thoroughly. I can't claim that," I said. "I love her, yet I am not close to her. I mean that when I am with you, as I am now, I know that I know nothing of her, nothing of anyone." "She's an era for you, an era of your life. If and when you break with her, You break with the only one alive who has shared that time with you. You fear that, the isolation of it, the burden, the scope of eternal life.